The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to another Tech Meme Ride Home bonus episode. I'm Brian McCullough. One of my favorite people to read every single week is the Wall Street Journal tech columnist Chris Mims. We talked about Chris's piece this week, positing that email was back, baby. And I read a piece that he did a while back about the new way of constructing super energy efficient homes. But when I did the email piece this week and remembered that he did a piece recently about how I'm more likely to get a burrito delivered to me for lunch from a self-driving vehicle than to have my self-driving wager come true by commuting to work myself in a robot car, I knew it was time to hit Chris up to come on the pod. And since he's a regular listener, he happily agreed.
When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation, where they check user identity. But user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months. Or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. How do you make a password that's strong enough so no one will guess it, and it's impossible for you to forget, and do it for 100 different sites, and make it so everyone in your company can do the same without ever needing to reset them? Sounds impossible unless you have 1Password. More than any other product I've ever told you about, I can vouch 1,000% for 1Password. I can't live without it. 1Password makes strong security easy for your people and gives you the visibility you need to take action when you need to. Any device, anytime, 1Password lets you securely switch between iPhone, Android, Mac, and PC with convenient features like autofill for quick sign-ins. All you have to remember is the one strong account password that protects everything else. Your logins, your credit cards, secure notes, or the office Wi-Fi password. 1Password's award-winning password manager is trusted by millions of users and over 100,000 businesses from IBM to Slack. It beat out 40 other options to become Wirecutter's top pick for password managers. Right now, my listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/ride for your growing business. That's 2 free weeks at 1Password.com/ride. Don't let security slow your business down. Go to 1Password.com/ride.
Now let's talk to the Wall Street Journal's Chris Mims.
So excited to be here. Long-time listener, first-time subject.
Well, look, having said that, I hope you won't be offended if I start like this, but I want to start with your email piece from this week, which, by the way, I think I even titled one of my episodes, like, Emails Back, Baby. Forgive me for starting like this. Can we be sure that email is back and this isn't a false positive? I mean, because of what you and I do, you know, everyone that we know and their mother has started an email newsletter in the last 18 months or so. So do you think that email is back for normal people too, or are we just noticing it because of what we do?
I think that email is back in the sense that direct mail is back, which, by the way, is literally true if you talk to MailChimp about it. where these channels never really go away. And if you think about all of marketing as just reaching people whenever and wherever their attention is available, unless there is a wholesale shift away from a channel, people are always going to return to it and find a way to make money off of it. And I think that email is back in the sense that people on the editorial side, I mean, you know, Axios, Quartz, The Skim, and then years before Thrill List, discovered that if you create something that's thoughtful, that is reaching people directly, that they're seeking out in their inbox, that that's incredibly high value. I think it's, you know, radio is back in the avatar of podcasts.
Right.
And I think that's the sense in which it is back. If you look at the numbers, you know, the number of emails that get sent every year globally, like, it keeps inching up. You know, how much of that is just, here's your receipt, is not clear. But, I mean, I'm definitely inside the same bubble that you are. Yeah, but, you know, when I see that somebody like Benedict Evidens of Andreessen Horowitz tweets once a week, my newsletter is out, please join 110,000 other people in reading it, I think, he's an influential guy. And people are clearly consuming content in this format and enjoying it.
Right. And you mentioned, how do you say his name? Judd Legum or whatever.
Yes.
Another successful newsletter guy. Okay. So there were two things that I thought of when I was reading this. Like, number one, is this possible now because, number one, as we're talking about, like, people are suddenly miraculously willing to pay for content, and this whole subscription model and Patreon model, is it maybe, especially for the newsletter part of it, is it that people finally have been culturated or whatever to pay for stuff that they like and seek it out?
That's part of it. I mean, a lot of these newsletters, keep in mind, are free, and a lot of the stuff that is being used for marketing purposes is, of course, no cost to anybody. But in the terms of the Substack phenomenon, the subscription newsletter phenomenon, definitely people are willing to pay for it. You know, everybody talks about Ben Thompson and Stratechery. he makes between $1 and $10 million a year, he won't say, on an email newsletter. And the top paid email newsletter creator on Substack makes north of $400,000 a year. I mean, that's unusual, right? Like, they're the head of this very long tail. But I do think with the Patreon phenomenon, I mean, I think I heard on your podcast, what is it? Patreon's going to hand out $500 million next year. And, you know, we're all used to subscribing to stuff. And I think that's a big part of it. We're ready to pay for content. And I think part of the reason we're ready to pay for content is the stuff that's free is not as good.
Well, then the other thing that I thought that I didn't see in your piece is, I wonder if this is only possible because spam is not as bad as it used to be. There, in no way is spam solved. But the you know, even 10 years ago, like, going to your inbox was just such a horrible experience. And, like, I wonder if, you know, because we're all sort of on Gmailish like things now and spam is sort of tamed a bit, I wonder if maybe, as you're describing, going to your inbox is more pleasurable suddenly, fascinatingly, than going to other things like feeds.
For sure. I saw somebody raving today about the the AI or the ML that they have put into Outlook, which is getting better at not just sorting out spam, but just sorting out spammy PR pitches, for example. And obviously, Gmail is good and very trainable in terms of getting stuff into those different tabs. And I saw one study that said, you know, when that rolled out, that actually increased people's engagement with that stuff. Because now, oh, thank you for organizing it for me. And it's, you know, one click unsubscribe to all the junk. And, you know, I'm only getting the stuff that I actually care about. I mean, email is this, you know, Taylor Lorenz's excellent piece about inbox infinity in The Atlantic, notwithstanding, if you pay attention to and use email, and I think everybody who's a professional has to, unless your company is entirely Slack, but then I don't see how you deal with vendors. The time that you put into email can make it a really, you know, exquisite tool. And I don't think we have that same power with, you know, social media being controlled by these algorithms. Like, you know, it just, email gives you all the knobs. And if you care about communication, you will use your powers like an audio engineer to adjust all those switches and make sure you're getting the stuff you want.
Right. That, so those are the other two parts that obviously you touched on that totally rang true for me. So number one, it's almost like you have more control in email, so you can almost, if you do a little bit of work, you can self-select for pleasure as opposed to just, you know, put your head under the deluge of crap on the feeds and the social media. But as you pointed out, it's also, again, going to the other side of the table. If, you know, we all were sold this bill of goods about social media, that it's all about amplifying your message and it's broadcasting your message or whatever. But the reality is that you're at the mercy of the algorithms that can throttle your reach, or in the worst case scenario, you know, shadow ban your message or something like that. So funny enough, good old email is actually still a tried and true way to reach people with your message completely unfettered.
Yeah, I wouldn't say unfettered, because definitely I heard from a lot of email marketers after writing this, and they were like, well, it's the perennial debate, more email or better email.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that said, like, if you have your sort of dedicated readers, you can reach them directly and consistently. And I think most important is, once you've built up that channel, that is not going to change. Whereas with Facebook, you know, you play by their rules, and next week there's an algorithm overhaul. And it's the same thing with SEO, which is just a constant game of cat and mouse. Every time you have that algorithm interceding, you can build, you know, a business on a particular channel and then just get smacked down when the channel changes. And that has happened to marketers, of course, who continue to adapt. But obviously, this is also why BuzzFeed just had to lay off 15% of their staff. It's because of Facebook algorithm changes. It's why Upworthy went away before then. It's why, you know, Mashable imploded after its attempt to pivot to video. Every single time that algorithm changes, you know, people are caught on their back foot, and that just doesn't happen with email. Email is, that is a hard channel to build. It takes a long time. It's slow, but it's like compound interest. It just gets bigger and bigger, and it's never going away.
But then, as bringing back to the consumer side of the table, as you pointed out, which was totally true and so obvious once you pointed it out to me, the unsubscribe link at the bottom of emails actually works. And again, you know, as compared to putting your face in front of the fire hose of a social media stream, the unsubscribe link is a quiet hero, because if there's annoying memes or messages or topics on social media, it's harder to funnel that stuff out and organize and things like that. But you can get annoying stuff to shut up in your email inbox.
Right, and it's not going to get offended that you unfollowed or muted it, for sure.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It works. It works. I mean, there's no – it's funny. Somebody told me, oh, I thought that was an industry standard. And I was like, no, it's the market working for once, where, you know, if enough of those emails get marked spam, the companies sending them have problems with ISPs just automatically marking their marketing or whatever emails as spam, and then real – or dedicated readers not getting it. So there's this incredibly powerful incentive of staying on those white lists that drives what, for 9 out of 10 emails, is a very straightforward unsubscribe process. And for the 1 out of 10 where it's a hassle and it's like, hey, okay, well, you got to log in with a password that you don't remember, and it's going to take you 5 minutes just to unsubscribe to this email. Really, the unsung hero isn't the unsubscribe button. It's that little mark as spam button.
Mm. Well, again, it's not solved, but the fact that your inbox is a lot more manageable than it used to be 10 years ago or so. Okay, so while I've still got you, let me shift gears real quick to another piece that I don't think I talked about on the show, but it has been something that has gotten on my radar lately. Your piece was titled "Why Your Ice Cream Will Ride in a Self-Driving Car Before You Do." And if longtime listener to the show, you know my ongoing when our self-driving car is going to be real in my life sort of wager. But it's gotten on my radar that, okay, I'm likely to get a burrito delivered to me for lunch sooner than I'll be able to commute to work in a self-driving car. We just had yesterday, Amazon, there was a headline that they're testing their Amazon Scout on real roads in Washington State. In your piece, it's interesting. It's almost the reverse of like the self-driving car thing, in the sense that it's simpler. Like, you don't have to worry. Like, who cares if your burrito gets a little must or whatever, as opposed to someone being hurt? So you can do things like put safety on the outside as opposed to safety on the inside. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, and there's a federal standard, and you know, there are state standards as well for low-speed vehicles. You know, anything that's 25 miles per hour and less, you know, it can't go on roads generally where the speed limit is over 35 miles per hour. Those vehicles are not subject to the safety standards, which all automobiles are subject to. And that's, you know, people say, oh, cars just all look the same. Look, there's two reasons for that. One is fuel standards demand that they be aerodynamic, roughly teardrop shaped. And then number two is safety standards demand that they have another totally contrary design constraint to make them, you know, bigger and stronger and everything. And at the intersection of the two of those is every blob-shaped car ever. And this standard lets you evade that completely. So you have a company like Nuro, which creates this, you know, 25-mile-per-hour thing that can drive on roads. It only carries groceries. You know, it can sacrifice itself in the event of a crash. Everybody you talk to who does autonomous on-road delivery talks about that possibility. Just the thing should just atomize if, you know, a butterfly lands on it, because you want to save the pedestrian or the car. And then you have the on-sidewalk delivery, right? Like, you've got Starship, like, they're very popular in the UK, in the like one town where they are, and they just rolled out on a university campus in the past week. And I think, and then you talk to Postmates, for example, and it's so fascinating, because part of the reason that this all works is it's just an easier kind of autonomy. If a Postmates robot freezes up and stops in the middle of the sidewalk, nobody dies. And a remote monitor can, you know, kind of log on and help it navigate whatever situation it couldn't handle. Whereas, you know, if you're trying to drive human beings on a road at 40 miles per hour, and there's construction, and it's a challenge even for a human to navigate that, what does your autonomous vehicle do? You know, that's why I think that, you know, Waymo is the standard bearer here, and they're kind of hinting at, well, you might never have, like, level 4 autonomy in our lifetime. Like, you, the most you can get is, like, most of the way there, and then you've still got to have a human who can at least you know, over a remote connection, jump in situations that are hairy or difficult. Like, it's just so much easier to move a thing, to the point that I think that the real barrier here is going to be that, you know, American cities, streets and sidewalks are just not that friendly to pedestrians, to cyclists, to people in wheelchairs. And, you know, that's what we need to make this delivery really work. Like, nothing is going to help Starship Robotics more than the Americans with Disabilities Act in terms of making cities accessible to those robots.
Okay, so that's because you said something really interesting in the piece about that too. So I, you know, again, I'm imagining I'm here in Dumbo, and you know, it's cobblestone roads and terribly maintained sidewalks. But then in your piece, you pointed out, which rings true to me, that like in suburban environments. I'm thinking of, like, you know, I grew up in Florida, like, sidewalks are super underutilized pieces of infrastructure. So, again, it's the bias of where I live, you know, but maybe the infrastructure is already there in large swaths of the country, possibly, because sidewalks are built, and then a lot of people don't drive or walk and run on them all the time. So maybe in suburbs, this can be real sooner than we think.
I think that's possible. I think the challenge there, of course, is the lower the density, the harder it is to make this really work and be profitable. And, you know, we just won't know. And there's so much math that is going to go into making that work. And it's going to be so weirdly contingent on all kinds of other factors, like how close is the nearest fully automated warehouse? Because don't forget that you have Kroger, America's largest grocery company, still, you know, has an exclusive contract with Ocado, which makes fully automated or nearly fully automated grocery warehouses. And, you know, I guarantee you that in the next 2 years, you will see an integration between a fully or a partially automated warehouse company of some kind and, you know, some delivery service, whether it's Uber or Postmates, you know, it's some fully or partially autonomous delivery service. And, you know, what efficiencies pop up there? And there's so many different models. So you just the number of different network topographies is mind-boggling. Like, imagine if fully automated small local warehouses turn out to be viable, and then that gets everybody in Starship Robotics range of, you know, an online-only grocery. What happens? You know?
Or like all the corner markets or gas stations become those sort of like node delivery warehouse sort of things. Yeah.
Right. So hybrid retail. So it's an actual store with this thing bolted on. Target is doing that. Walmart is doing that. Amazon is clearly trying to do that with Whole Foods. And then you have these sort of mixed modality delivery options. So what Postmates is doing with their robot is they will actually get the goods from a dense urban area. Like imagine Market Street in San Francisco where traffic is awful. And so they will utilize the sidewalk there to get goods onto Postmates robots, which will then all arrive at the same time at the vehicle of a human driver who's then going to take those deliveries to some far-flung suburban location. So don't forget that the robot itself doesn't have to make the entire trip. So when you just imagine all the potential combinations of business models and types of robots on-road, off-road, you know, eventually flying drone type delivery stuff. Like, it is truly, truly mind-boggling. Like, it is going to take us decades or centuries to explore that full parameter space and come up with a totally new model for e-commerce and delivery.
I'm just even imagining, like, so your UPS truck, as you see now, just rolls up to a location and boom, like 30 different little children run off to actually make the deliveries on their own and that sort of thing. Real quick, give me a quick sketch of this. Is there a Waymo of this space, or is Waymo the Waymo of this space, or like are there people that are doing this exclusively, or is anybody that's in autonomy kind of dabbling in this as well?
They're all dabbling. Obviously, everybody, you know, who has a autonomous vehicle is like, maybe it could be used for deliveries too. You know, the ones that are, I count at least a half dozen what I would call full stack robot delivery companies. And I can't remember all, you know, it's like ones you've heard of, like Starship and Neuro, and ones you haven't, like AutoX. So, you know, which one of those is going to be the Waymo of this? I have no idea. I mean, definitely Starship has an early lead in terms of the on sidewalk stuff, and Neuro does as well. But it's just, it's absolutely not clear. You know, if there could be some really fast moving second movers in this space, partly because I think the autonomous technology is just, that's going to come down in price so fast. You're going to, you know, all these enabling technologies like solid state LiDAR and just, you know, all the stuff that NVIDIA is doing with shrinking and making more power sipping their systems for doing autonomy. You could just see this this Cambrian explosion of different companies trying to do it, like you saw with scooters.
Well, the funny thing is, every time I visualize this, like you just made me visualize the UPS truck, and then there's, you know, these 30 little bots that go out instead of driving around to make all the deliveries. It always reminds me of the Death Star in the original Star Wars, or those little box bots that are always running around, running into people's ankles and things like that. It'll be hilarious. Like, if that actually, so then, right, if 5 years from now there's little Death Star like box bots running around on the sidewalks that you've got to worry about tripping over, like, I'll find that hilarious, I think.
Yeah, well, you also keep in mind that there's the in-building component, so literally that is also happening, and that could happen even sooner. If you think it's easier to navigate on a sidewalk than on the street, you know, as long as you can navigate an elevator and stuff, like, buildings are kind of optimal.
Yeah.
You know, so all your Postmates deliveries all show up at the front desk, and then it all gets distributed throughout your skyscraper by the little bots.
Well, and then you got to start designing the skyscrapers to accommodate for that easier. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Amazing. Before I let you go, you have an amazing podcast that I am a fan of, that I listen to every episode, called Instant Message. So if no one's heard of Instant Message that's listening right now, please tell them about Instant Message and why they should listen.
Instant Message is me and David Pierce and Joanna Stern having fun for a third of it, telling you things that you can't get anywhere else because it's fascinating details from our respective reporting that never make it into print. And then there is another third that is David interviewing a reporter who has gone mind-numbingly deep on a topic and again is going to tell you something that you will literally hear nowhere else, even in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. So that's amazing. And then the last third, and I know this is 133%, is, you know, again, David interviewing somebody really fascinating who, you know, you may have heard somewhere else, but never interviewed by Mr. Pierce with his uniquely penetrating 60 minutes.
He had a great interview with somebody at CES, one of those scooter people, Segway guy, I think, that I was really jealous of because it got really deep into stuff that I had never thought about. But also, I'm going to say this: the reason I'm a fan is because it's fun, and there are certain tech podcasts that I used to be a fan of years ago because they were fun, and then they got less fun. You guys do have fun, which is what makes it great.